Thank you very much for coming tonight, and thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here. I first like to tell something about my book. A gentleman in the audience a few minutes ago asked me what was different about my book than the various other books that have been written about Jubal Early's raid on Washington. The two that immediately come to mind are Dr. Cooling's outstanding book, Jubal Early's Raid on Washington, 1864, and Frank Vandiver's book on Jubal Early's raid, which is also an excellent book, but an older book. I'd like to say that my book presents a lot of new information on the raid. I didn't quite find out why Jubal Early failed to capture Washington. I think he took that to the grave with him, and I'm sure he never heard the end of it after the war. But I did find out some things, such as the supply of food in Loudoun County was more than adequate to have supported the Army of the Valley had they chose to march that way. There were thousands of gallons of milk, bushels of wheat, and thousands of head of beef cattle available. But Early was told by John Mosby that there wasn't enough food or forage in Loudoun County to support the Army of the Valley. Now, I think Mosby probably just had some bad information because at that point the bad feeling that developed between Early and Mosby hadn't yet really got going. So, and in any event, Mosby was very loyal to the Confederacy, and he in no way would have said anything in any kind of mean-spirited or petty way that would have kept Jubal Early and the Army of the Valley from doing everything they could to advance the Confederate cause. So I found that there was, in fact, more than enough food to have supported the Army of the Valley. And I think that Hugh Swartz probably told Early that not enough grain had been harvested in the valley. The soldiers were very partial to making bread around the campfire at night. They would put flour in their frying pans and fry it up in the pan and make bread out of it. But be that as it may, Jubal Early didn't corroborate the information he got. He didn't send out a scout into Loudoun County to find that, well, maybe there is enough food there. Instead, he took the word of somebody he mistrusted, a freebooter, as he called John Mosby. Freebooters, in his cantankerous way. So he took their word for it, which led me to believe that the capture of Washington was not his number one priority. So there was that, and then I spend an entire chapter 3, in explaining the ransoming of Frederick, economic warfare, Southern style, and the 20th century attempts of Senator Mathias to get the federal government to reimburse the city of Frederick for the paying the ransom demand that they took 87 years and several bond issues authorized by the Maryland State Legislature to pay back. I have in chapter 8 also, I have some fresh light on why Chambersburg was left undefended at the end of July 1864. Well, everybody knows that the Confederates wanted revenge for Hunter and Sheridan for their depredations in the Shenandoah Valley. David Hunter burned down the home of his first cousin. And he was quite a piece of work, David Hunter. And I believe that his cousin had a ring that was given to him by David Hunter with some tender familial inscription on it. But David Hunter burned his house down and the houses of a number of other people in Jefferson County, West Virginia, as he burned the entire town of Buchanan, Virginia, on the way to Lynchburg. So it's quite understandable that the Confederates wanted revenge. However, if the Federal High Command had had their wits about them, they could very well have stopped the Chambersburg raid. And it's right there in the official records in OR that Edwin Stanton refused to issue clothing for militia companies. Governor Bradford of Maryland and Governor Andrew Curtin of Pennsylvania had written Lincoln on the 21st and 22nd of July, literally begging the administration to issue clothing so that they could raise militia companies, quickly raise militia companies to defend the border. Well, Stanton not only did not reply, he did not reply until after Chambersburg had been destroyed. And this was a very curious episode to me because the previous year, during the Gettysburg campaign, Lincoln had intervened and he had said that, well, the Secretary Stanton had better issue the clothing in question. Well, so Stanton issued the clothing in 1863, and the Pennsylvania militia did a very good job of defending Carlisle from Jeb Stuart's cavalry. 1864, I don't know what happened. Maybe Lincoln didn't receive the telegrams because the replies were sent on behalf of Secretary of War Stanton. And Stanton turned both Bradford and Curtin down. And therefore, there was no militia raised. And there was also an incident where a very long supply train that was guarded by 1,700 troops, Union troops, passed through Chambersburg on the night of July 29th, 1864. But General Couch, who was in charge of the Department of the Susquehanna, didn't have the authority to order any of those troops to leave the train and defend the town because they were under the command of David Hunter, not Couch. And so none of those troops left the train, and the train just passed right on through with the result that Chambersburg was destroyed. I also write in Chapter 9, Debacle at Moorefield, about the little-known but very important Battle of Moorefield. And why was the Battle of Moorefield important? Well, I can explain it in one word: morale. The Battle of Moorefield shows how important morale is in warfare. because by the time of that fight, the Confederate cavalry under McCausland and Johnson didn't have very much morale left. And it showed in the way they fought, in the way they were hunted down, and in the way that they lost. But to be fair to them, they did not have as good, they were not as well armed as the Federals. And I also put in a great deal of information on the Democratic National Convention, the political background of Early's raid, which I don't think you'll find in any other book on the subject. I thought that the candidacy of George B. McClellan was very interesting. He conducted his presidential campaign in the same way that he conducted his military campaigns, very hesitating and unsure of himself. And they didn't deal very successfully with Clement Vallandigham and the war failure plank. He inserted the war failure plank into the Democratic platform, which just basically destroyed McClellan's chances of winning. So for those reasons, I think that my book is unique, and I think that it follows all the way, the Army of the Valley, all the way through to the Battle of Waynesboro. And I also talk about the Democratic the presidential election in November 1864 in New York City as a way of showing more about the Civil War and advancing knowledge of the Civil War. So those are the reasons I think why my book is unique and is well worth the $31 I'm asking for it. $31. Publisher's list price is $35, but I'm sorry. I'm offering folks a 10% discount on it. So, but I think I could also say that above all else, the Confederacy's last northern offensive is a study in failure, and failure on both sides. I look at the Civil War, as many people do, that the turning point, the major turning point, was the first week in July of 1863, where the South lost the Battle of Gettysburg. And at the same time, almost on the same day, Grant took Vicksburg. And so the momentum of the war swung in favor of the North. And I think the side with the fewest mistakes, who makes the fewest mistakes, will win. Before Gettysburg, the North made most of the mistakes. Afterwards, it seems like the South did. And they had a chance to recover the momentum after the Battle of Chickamauga. I think many people would agree that if they had captured Chattanooga, that they might have, and then chased the Union Army out of Tennessee, that they would have regained the momentum that they had lost at Gettysburg. But that never happened. And I think history is defined as, just as equally defined by what doesn't happen as by what does. So I think that the Confederacy's last northern offensive is a study in failure. Failure, for example, of Hunter to capture Lynchburg. Had he done that, Early's raid most likely would not have occurred. the failure of Grant to realize that the Second Corps had left the Army of Northern Virginia. Grant dropped the ball on that one. He wasn't aware. He suspected, but he wasn't really fully aware that Early's men had left the front at Petersburg until they were crossing the Potomac River into Maryland. And at that point, he says, oh, my God, I better do something about this. And he sends a corps, he puts a corps of men on the steamboat and sends them up the Chesapeake Bay to Washington. Early's failure to march through Snicker's Gap and into and through Loudoun County. Lew Wallace understood that that was a big mistake, and he says that in his memoirs. Early was a good soldier, but he will now lose that reputation. And the general with him asks why. Why is that? And Wallace replies to the effect that he had only to cross the Potomac at Edwards Ferry, and Washington would be his. He would be in Washington now. And the general says, what? Impossible. Can't, never happen. Wallace says, not at all. He would be in Washington right now if he had done that. Well, here we're back to the same old question. Why didn't Jubal Early capture Washington? To answer that question, I think you have to know something about the man, a very good soldier, a very brave man. But he was basically did things by the book. And he was a good battalion commander, a good brigade commander, a good division commander. But he was not the type of man to go out and find out whatever way he could to win. He was concentrating on revenge. He was concentrating on getting the people of Frederick to pay that ransom, and the people of Hagerstown, the people of Middletown. He was going after small potatoes, revenge, and he got it. But in doing so, he sacrificed the opportunity to capture Washington and deal a body blow to the Northern war effort. Well, this is the quandary that historians find themselves in. Why didn't Jubal Early capture Washington? You've got to put yourself in the shoes of the people who lived history before you can understand answers to questions like that. And I tried to do that. I think that Early didn't care a great deal about what most other people thought of him. He cared a lot about what Lee thought. And Lee's orders were to destroy the B&O Railroad and the C&O Canal and keep them in a more or less continual state of disrepair. Lee had an idea of stopping the coal shipments coming in from the mountain regions out in western Maryland, because that was thought to be a way to put pressure on the Lincoln administration if people were to go without coal. The problem with that was, and I think they realized this too late, was that there was no way to permanently destroy a railroad. Sherman proved that in his advance on Atlanta when he had especially designated guards led by General James Steedman to protect the railroad and special units of mechanics that could fix the railroad as fast as Confederate cavalry could destroy it. And in many places, he had locked gates protecting the track. But they couldn't have known that at that time. Another big failure on the part of the Confederates was their failure to press the attack on Point Lookout prison compound. I think they tried to do too much with too few resources. They diverted Harry Gilmore and Bradley Johnson on some scheme to destroy the Magnolia, the bridge over the Gunpowder River, which was quickly repaired. But they were so far away from the Point Lookout prison camp that there was no way Bradley Johnson was going to get there by 3 o'clock in the morning of July the 12th. And so they had a chance to free 15 or 16,000 prisoners there, which could very well have been done. However, Jefferson Davis believed what a New York newspaper reporter wrote, that most of the prisoners had been transferred to Elmira. And so on July 10th, he canceled the raid. So I think he dropped the ball there, and it was a very important fumble. Here's a chance to get another 15 or 16,000 men. They badly needed these men, but they didn't get them. As I say, they made most of the mistakes after Gettysburg. And so they went down to defeat. Chambersburg, I already explained. Failure of Early and McCausland to maintain morale. Another question that somebody asked me at another talk was to explain why Lincoln exposed himself to enemy fire at Fort Stevens. Well, historians are fond of saying that this was curiosity on Lincoln's part. Undoubtedly, it was. Confederate sharpshooters failed to hit President Lincoln, and they knew they were shooting at him because they had captured a few of them and questioned them, and they said they knew they were shooting at Abraham Lincoln. Here's a 6'4" man wearing a 10-inch stovepipe hat and a long yellow frock coat standing up on the parapet there for 15 or 20 minutes. He's a very, very brave man. Also very, very lucky. But he does it 2 days in a row. Now, I don't think curiosity is the entire motivation, is his entire motivation. He's got to do whatever he can to show the people of the North he's not afraid of the Confederates. Lincoln stays in the White House for even one of those days, his presidency is gone. At that point, his presidency is hanging by a thread. People are very disappointed in him. A lot of people are very angry at him. Northern civilians have made all kinds of sacrifices. Their sons and brothers and fathers and next-door neighbors have gone off to war. They've paid all kinds of property taxes to finance commutations from the draft and various other sacrifices. So they don't like Lincoln at this point at all. So if Lincoln stays in the White House, I think he might very well have lost the election. Another thing I put in the book is Sherman's advance on Atlanta. I wanted to show that that the federal policy at that point was to make total war on the South. That's one reason I put that there. But it highlights another failure of the Confederates, the failure to blow up Tunnel Hill. What was Tunnel Hill? It was a 1,500-foot-long tunnel through Chattoogeta Mountain, Georgia. And on the Western Atlantic Railroad, had they blown up that tunnel, it probably would have taken a month and a half to clear the debris and get the trains moving again. Might very well have postponed Sherman's advance on Atlanta long enough for Lincoln to lose the election. Early made a tremendous mistake at Winchester. He scatters his army in front of a superior force. They march off to Martinsburg, 20 miles away from where they are, 22 miles north of Winchester on a straight line. In the meantime, Sheridan has 35,000 infantry arrayed against Early's 13,000 men. Why did he do it? I don't know. And I think only he knew. But Henry Kidd Douglas remarked that the air has a sulfurous smell when he did that. So they go off to Martinsburg, and they break into the telegraph office, and they find some telegrams that tell them that Grant has been meeting with Phil Sheridan just a couple of days ago, not too far away. So they get real scared. And I think one of the few times Early is scared. And they turn around and they try to get back to Winchester as fast as they can, but it's too late. And they're scattered there in front of the Federals, and Sheridan attacks Early the following morning. And Ramseur is not prepared to meet him. He's got 2,500 men at the mouth of the Berryville Canyon, which, by the way, doesn't look anything today like it must have looked like back then. Today it's graded, and they've got one road about 50 feet above the other road. One is going one way, the other is going the other way. But Ramseur is not really prepared to meet Sheridan. He's got 2,500 men, makes no attempt to ambush Sheridan's men in the canyon, and it's all he can do to stop Sheridan long enough for the rest of the Confederates to get back there. As it is, Sheridan almost loses the Battle of Winchester. One thinks what might have happened if Early had not made that fatal trek to Martinsburg. Another mistake, Early's failure to retain Kershaw's division. Why did Kershaw's men leave? Kershaw had 3,500 men, Joseph B. Kershaw. One author speculates that Early and Kershaw didn't get along. It's plausible, given Early's penchant for sarcasm and sarcastic humor, and didn't have the best diplomatic abilities. So those are a few of the mistakes that the Confederates made. Fortunately or unfortunately, but so they went down to defeat. And I think the Battle of Winchester was arguably the most important battle in the spring 1864 campaign. After that battle, Early lost the confidence and respect of his troops, and he never got it back. And with that, I'll conclude and leave the floor open to questions. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I was surprised to hear that there was some animosity between Early and Mosby. And what is a freebooter?
A pirate?
A looter. A freebooter. After the Battle of Cedar Creek, or I guess this was after the war, somebody on Early's staff asked somebody had asked early if he would consider allowing Mosby to attack the rear of the Federals at Cedar Creek while Early's men attacked them in the front. And Early replied that he was not going to do the fighting while Mosby did the plundering. That gives you an idea of, a little bit of an idea of who Jubal Early was. And he was, yes.
Was that the remark you said that was after the war?
After the war, Mosby found out that someone on Early's staff had asked him whether or not it could be a two-pronged attack whereby Mosby would attack the rear.
He found it out after the war, but it was made during the war.
Right.
Because after the war, Mosby and Longstreet were both Republicans, so Early would have had reason to write things like he did in his memoir the last year of the war, where he attacked them not based on what they were doing during the war, but their alignment with Grant after the war.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Gentleman in the tie.
How many troops did Early have when he was in front of Fort Stevens? And what was the garrison in Washington for federal troops that could have been gathered to oppose him trying to capture him?
On paper, Washington had about 31,000 men. Effectively, they had about 9,600 troops, or as they say, troops on the ground, of varying quality to oppose Early. This was before the Sixth Corps arrived. However, I think you may want to know that the forts on the eastern side of the Anacostia were entirely unmanned. There wasn't a soldier in any of those forts, nor were there any men in the connecting trenches between them. So any force that wanted to attack Washington could very easily have done so through the Anacostia side of the city. But I don't think they knew that. Washington was ripe for the taking throughout most of the war. And I say that in my book. I can't really understand to this day the Confederate strategy of focusing solely on defeating the enemy in the field without giving a thought to fighting battles for political gain. Stonewall Jackson wanted to carry the war to northern civilians. Stonewall Jackson wanted to bombard Philadelphia. Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis didn't like that idea. Their idea was to defeat the enemy in the field, which I think was the most practical of the two. And yet I still couldn't understand when I started writing the book why there was only one half-hearted attempt to capture Washington in the entire war. Didn't make very much sense to me, but again, we're back at home plate. History doesn't make sense, so it's the job of the historian to put himself in the shoes of those who lived it. And I guess it was because they thought that the war would not last for 4 years. Davis and his generals thought that they could outlast the North by fighting a defensive war, cordon defense. It almost worked.
Given these reasons, good ones, I think that Early didn't take Washington, but you didn't want to mention the Battle of Monocacy. Does it deserve its reputation as the battle that saved Washington?
Yes, it does. I firmly believe that it does. I firmly believe that had Lew Wallace not been there, Yeah, absolutely saved the day. Of course, we're only talking about the Confederates occupying D.C. for a couple of days. But during that time, they could have burned the White House, the Capitol building, the Treasury building, and destroyed the Washington Navy Yard and driven Lincoln and the Cabinet and the Congress out of town, a big body blow to the Northern war effort. Yes, I do very much believe that Monocacy was the battle that saved Washington, sure.
Yes? Buell do right after the Battle of Winchester?
I'm sorry?
What did Buell Early do right after the Battle of Winchester?
Right after the battle? The Confederate Army was at that point basically a mob. And they were retreating up the Valley Turnpike. And I suppose he made some committed attempts to impose order and discipline with varying degrees of success. And they relocated to Fisher's Hill, where they were further winnowed down to about 9,500 troops. And during the research for this book, I visited Fisher's Hill, and it's an enormous area to defend. You drive down Route 11, State Route 11, which then was the Valley Turnpike, and you make a right turn, you go past this big 300-foot-high bluff that comes almost right up to the Shenandoah River, just a couple of miles south of Strasburg. And you go up this long hill for about 3/4 of a mile, and you make a right turn, and then you make a left, and you go under a railroad bridge, and you go past the post office there, and then drive for about another 1.5 miles, and you come to the Ramsers Hill Interpretive Site. And that whole area, that 3 miles, and for maybe another mile beyond that, all they had was 9,500 troops to hold that area. See? And I think by that time, Jubal Early had given up because he put his weakest troops, the cavalry of Bradley Johnson and McCausland, in the path of Crook's attack coming down from Little North Mountain. And these are Sheridan's best troops for all intents and purposes. And Early doesn't support his cavalry. He's always directing his sarcasm at them. He doesn't do anything to improve their morale, their weaponry, or anything else. And he puts them in the path of Crook's attack. And they crumple and vanish in a matter of minutes. And you have the makings of another defeat. So I think by that time, Early had, I think he had thrown in the towel. Good soldier and brave man that he was. I think Winchester is what did it. Yes, sir.
Early's failure to take Washington, from his point of view, could he have been, I don't know how much of a student of history he was, but he had the precedence of 50 years before. The British had taken Washington. They had destroyed the Navy Yard. They had burned the White House. They stayed there for a day or two, and they left. And really, it had no effect. Could he have been looking at, well, if I do this, I will have to leave and will have no effect, but the chances are that things can go bad. So do you think in any way what happened 50 years earlier was on his mind at all?
It's a very good point. That's a very good question. It's entirely possible, but I tend to doubt it. I think you're really comparing apples to oranges there because
they were different situations.
Right, and the British still had to fight the Americans at Baltimore afterwards. But I think that the political, the timing of Early's raid had the potential to destroy Lincoln's administration if he's successful. But that is a good point. Yes, sir.
Just curious, the idea you're saying, the idea of going to Point Lookout, you know, and bring the prisoners, you know, there, it's kind of like off this point, off the table. Was there ever really a thought about, say he did hit Washington, let's say he took an occupied for a couple of days, then goes down to Point Lookout. What was the escape route from there? What was the plan after that? Or was there ever really a plan? Did they ever think beyond that?
The Point Lookout raid was supposed to have been a joint attack from the sea as well as the land. John Taylor Wood had some steamers up there, was supposed to have some steamers hit the prison compound at 3 o'clock in the morning. And Bradley Johnson's cavalry was supposed to hit them from the land side. The plan was to march them up to Washington, D.C., and somehow arm them on the way. The details were not worked out. I don't think they put enough planning into it, and don't think they had enough time. I don't think they planned it very well. But it could have worked. Yes?
It's kind of another hypothetical. Is at what point during this whole sequence does he lose the confidence of the administration, Jefferson Davis, or even Robert E. Lee, for that matter? It's something that I've kind of wondered over the years. I haven't really. At what point during this whole campaign, you know, upon his return to Richmond, Appomattox?
Early, I think he lost the confidence of his men, certainly right after Fisher's Hill, because he doesn't conduct the Battle of Cedar Creek. He's just kind of there as a figurehead. Kershaw and Gordon and Wharton and Ramsar conducted Cedar Creek. So by that point, I think he... when does he lose the confidence of Robert E. Lee?
He got relieved, correct?
Well, no. He got relieved after the Battle of Waynesboro.
Okay.
So Robert E. Lee still retained confidence in him until the middle of March 1865. Speaks volumes about Robert E. Lee's integrity and willingness to support his commanders.
Last question.
Could you tell us a little something about Jubal Early? Where was he born? Who was he?
Jubal Early was born in Franklin County, Virginia, I believe, November 3rd, 1816. He was the son of Joab Early, and they named him, biblical names were very important in his family, and his mother's name has slipped my mind, but his father, I believe, was Joab, and his formal name was Jubilee, and he was a lawyer before the war. He did get married, but it was a common law marriage, as so many marriages were at the time. After the war, he went to Mexico and fought for Emperor Maximilian. Came back to America in 1869 and then went to Canada for a while. And when he got back from Canada, he got involved with something called the Louisiana Lottery. This was a money-making operation in New Orleans that employed two Confederate generals to publicize their operation, Pierre Beauregard and Early. And I think Pierre Beauregard hired him. And they did very well for themselves for several years, which was fortunate for Early because he was getting on in age, and the war had left him poverty-stricken. He received Robert E. Lee's letter of dismissal at his sister's home in Marion, Virginia. I don't know whether he had a home to go back to. I'm not sure of that. But he was pretty much poverty-stricken, left poverty-stricken by the war. But he did very well for himself with the Louisiana Lottery. And he retired to Lynchburg and lived out the rest of his life in an apartment on the second floor of an old warehouse in Lynchburg. And people would visit him and talk about the stories that he would tell, some of which were true and some of which were not. And I understand that he died. He fell down the steps of the bank in Lynchburg in February 1894, and they put him in the hospital. And 2 weeks later, on March 2nd, he died at age 77.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.